It's the KVMR Evening News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2011. I'm Paul Emery. And you are listening to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City. After the news headlines, Christopher Martinez will report from the state capitol about some bills that are not going to make it through this year's legislative deadline, which is today. Free Speech Radio News will give us an update on the latest happenings in Syria, and I'll be speaking with Zach Anderson about the Forest Trails Alliance and the trail fair that's happening this weekend in Nevada City. Closing out today's newscast, we'll have an essay by Mark Cunaberty. At 6:30, we'll air a special edition of Making Contact, and at 7 o'clock, as usual, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. But first, Felton Pruitt with today's news headlines.
CNN reports that Mitt Romney will win the Florida primary in a result that will cement the front-running status of the former Massachusetts governor for the Republican presidential nomination. The CNN production was based on unofficial returns and exit polling that showed Romney with a double-digit lead over his closest challenger, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. With 51% of the unofficial count, Romney had 48% of the vote compared to 31% for Gingrich, 13% for former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, and 7% for Texas Representative Ron Paul. Final polls closed at 8 p.m. Eastern, and the early trend for Romney, buoying a strong support among more than 632,000 voters who cast absentee or early ballots, indicated a solid victory to blunt any momentum Gingrich gained from last week's victory in South Carolina. According to exit poll information, Romney led in most categories to show his appeal to Republican voters, who said their main concern was choosing a candidate who can defeat President Barack Obama in November. The victory gives Romney all 50 of Florida's convention delegates, and more importantly, new momentum heading into a series of caucuses and primaries in the next month, building up to Super Tuesday on March 6, when 10 states will hold nominating contests. The UK Guardian reports that BP will not be able to hand off a share of the $40 billion in cleanup costs and economic losses from the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster to Halliburton, a judge in New Orleans has ruled. The decision from U.S. District Judge Carl Barbier, who will hear the main case for damages against BP next month, quashes the oil company's hopes of collecting a share of the cleanup costs from Halliburton. A White House investigation found Halliburton had used flawed cement in constructing the BP well, leading to the April 2010 blowout, which killed 11 men on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig and spewed 4.9 million barrels of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. However, Barbier wrote in his decision that BP must indemnify Halliburton from damage claims under the terms of its drilling contract. Halliburton is still on the hook for fines, however. Barbier wrote that BP is required to indemnify Halliburton for third-party compensatory claims that arise from pollution or contamination that did not originate from the property or equipment of Halliburton located above the surface of the land or water, even if Halliburton's gross negligence caused the problem. The Los Angeles Times reports that an effort to get more states to require convicted drunk drivers to test their breath for alcohol before they can start their cars is gaining support in Congress. A House transportation bill unveiled today would offer additional highway funds to states that require ignition interlock devices for DUI offenders. A similar measure is expected to come before the Senate. 15 states require all convicted drunk drivers, including first-time offenders, to use the devices, according to Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which has promoted use of the devices. The ignition interlock prevents a driver from starting the engine if his or her blood alcohol content exceeds a preset limit. In a pilot project that runs through 2016, DUI offenders in Los Angeles County and three other California counties were required to install the devices in their cars beginning in 2010. The idea of requiring the devices for all drunk drivers is opposed by the American Beverage Institute, a restaurant trade association. The Sacramento Bee reports that roughly 700 state workers covered by SEIU Local 1000 will receive back wages from a furlough lawsuit agreement between the union and Governor Jerry Brown's administration. The deal also dumps four much larger furlough lawsuits the union was pressing in Northern California trial courts. Only Local 1000 employees at First Five California, the Prison Industry Authority, the California Earthquake Authority, the California Housing Finance Agency, and the California State Lottery will receive back pay without interest for days that they were forced to take off without pay in 2009 and 2010. State workers represented by other bargaining units and managers in those organizations aren't part of the settlement, said Linnell Jolly, spokeswoman for the State Department of Personnel Administration. The agreement is a good deal for the state on two fronts. It costs taxpayers nothing since all five departments are completely self-funded, which was the basis of the argument that their employees shouldn't have been put on furlough in the first place. SEIU also agreed to drop four other furlough lawsuits pending in Alameda, Sacramento, and San Francisco courts, Jolly said. Those lawsuits had the potential to cost the state tens of millions of dollars in back wages and interest for roughly 80,000 of the 95,000 workers the local represents. The litigation argued that for a variety of reasons, furlough policy itself was illegal, not merely its application to a select department. The union reports that two elementary schools in Lake Wildwood went into lockdown just as the school day ended this evening, as local law enforcement searched for a man suspected of carrying a handgun. Nevada County Sheriff's deputies initially responded to a call of a domestic dispute from a woman in the 17,000 block of Shelter Court at about 2 p.m., said Sheriff Keith Royal. She said that her son was beating up his girlfriend and a loud disturbance was heard in the background, Royal said. Then she said he left on foot running towards Pleasant Valley School and that he had a handgun. Sheriff's deputies began combing the area, as did California Highway Patrol officers and canine units. A CHP helicopter was also dispatched. KVMR just talked with the Nevada County Sheriff's Office, and they have confirmed that Cody Cook, 20 years old, has been apprehended and is now in the Nevada County Jail. Cook has a long history with law enforcement, including an arrest for assault and battery, Sheriff Royal said. The weather forecast for Nevada City, Grass Valley, and the foothills is calling for rain, mainly after 4 a.m. this evening with a low around 38. The chance of precipitation is 60%. On Wednesday, showers likely, mainly before 10 p.m., then partly sunny with a high near 53 and a low around 34. On Thursday, sunny with a high near 58 and a low around 33. In Sacramento tonight, a 30% chance of rain, mainly after 4 a.m. with a low of 43. On Wednesday, a 50% chance of rain before 10 a.m., partly sunny with a high near 58 and a low around 39. And on Thursday, in the Sacramento area, sunny with a high near 61 and a low around 38. In Truckee tonight, snow showers likely after 4 a.m. with a low of 25. The chance of precipitation is 60%. Total nighttime snow accumulation of less than a half inch is possible. On Wednesday, snow showers likely mainly before 10 a.m., gradually becoming sunny with a high near 39 and a low of 14. And on Thursday in the Truckee area, it should be mostly sunny with a high near 43 and a low around 12. That's the KVMR Evening News Headlines. I'm Felton Pruitt.
Republicans in Florida are heading to the polls today to vote for their presidential nominee. Though polls show Mitt Romney with a wide lead in the swing state, some Republicans are concerned about recent attacks made by rival Newt Gingrich that labeled Romney as anti-immigrant, a term that could potentially damage Romney if he were to go on to challenge President Obama. 13% of Florida's voters are Hispanic, and the state has one of the highest populations of undocumented immigrants. FSRN's Kelly Benjamin has more.
Last week, the issue of immigration shot to center stage in the Florida primary race when Newt Gingrich abruptly pulled a Spanish-language campaign spot that described Mitt Romney as anti-immigrant. The ad drew a quick response from U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, who called it inaccurate and inflammatory. The Gingrich campaign removed the ad, but the label could stick with Romney if he goes on to win his party's nomination and face off against Barack Obama in November. All of this highlights what a delicate issue immigration is in Florida as compared to states like Iowa or South Carolina, where the GOP candidates had no problem taking a hardline stance. Florida political commentator and blogger Peter Schorsch says that the immigration issue could be the Achilles heel of the Republican Party this election.
They don't know where they're at on this issue because, number one, you can just do the math and we know how important the Hispanic vote is coming. And when you say the things that people in the Republican Party say, you lose votes. They've got to take this pro-Cuban, anti-Castro stance, but then they've got to tie that back in with their Tea Party-influenced anti-immigrant stance. And that's why you see it, like, they were literally changing their position on immigration or having to walk back their position on immigration or having to clarify their position on immigration hour by hour.
This flip-flopping on immigration has only solidified the significance of the Hispanic vote in the upcoming presidential election, according to Juan Rodriguez, a youth organizer with the Florida Immigrant Coalition.
We don't understand exactly what's going on. The community's just been going out saying that they've had enough with the anti-immigrant rhetoric. Latinos and immigrants across this country have been crucial to the prosperity of different economic systems in agriculture, in the service industry, in tourism, and we're doing everything we can to provide a fair and equal future for the young people who are growing up in these states, trying to get an equal chance.
Rodriguez says he finds it troubling that candidates like Mitt Romney have threatened to veto the DREAM Act, a bill that would provide a path to citizenship for undocumented youth who came to the U.S. as children if they complete a college degree or serve in the military.
The DREAM Act has always been, across the board, a common sense solution to a gap that we have in our immigration system that needs to be addressed. In terms of the candidates, one of the major criticisms that, you know, our community members have been raising is the way they keep trying to strip down the DREAM Act, take away so many provisions that would provide opportunities and provide hope to young people and their futures. Even when they try to sound moderate, they're talking mainly about putting young people into the military and that being their only option for legalization.
Besides immigration and the DREAM Act, another issue that Republicans may find themselves in hot water over in Florida is Cuba. While the hardline Cold War rhetoric on Cuba has been safe for Republicans in the past, University of South Florida professor Mara Barrios says a new generation of Cuban Americans have a much different view.
Actually, Cuban Americans in Florida have changed quite a bit. There's a shifting opinions on the embargo by Cubans in the Miami area. So there's this disconnect with the reality of today and the old rhetoric of Cold War rhetoric. And, you know, the younger Cuban Americans are going to vote, and their thinking is very different than the old-timers.
26-year-old Guido Maniscalco is one of those first-generation Cuban Americans whose thinking is very different from the old-timers. While the young Republican says he supports much of his party's platform, he sees the continued embargo on Cuba as a mistake.
The embargo to me is a failure, because what have we essentially done? Castro is still in power. His brother is now in power. You know, they're not going to live forever. They're up in age. My grandma's of an age. A lot of people from that generation have passed away. And me being a first-generation American, my mother being born in Cuba but coming here as a young girl, we look at it as if we were to open talks, discuss trade with Cuba, I think it would only benefit promoting democracy.
Tuesday's primary election in Florida will provide Republicans their first test of support among the rapidly evolving Latino demographic. About 450,000 Latinos are registered as Republicans, according to the Florida Division of Elections. That's about 11% of all registered Republicans in the state. Kelly Benjamin, FSRN, Tampa, Florida.
By the end of the day on January 31st, state lawmakers will have voted on the last of the year's proposed bills, or decided to hold their measures back for a better day. The Assembly voted Monday to reject a measure that would have amended California's three strikes law, and it debated another measure to change the state's laws on registering sex offenders. Assemblymember Tom Amiano had proposed a measure to create a tiered system to deal with people convicted of sex offenses, saying California's one-size-fits-all system should be replaced by a tiered system based on the type of offense. Republican lawmakers blasted the measure. Assemblymember Jim Nielsen is a Republican from Gerber.
They have a sentence. They must abide by that sentence. It's, again, similar to the three strikes now. This is the time to be kind to criminals, ladies and gentlemen. And if there's any kind of criminal that do not deserve our kindness and whose children do not deserve to be put at risk at their hands, it is of sex offenders. I urge a no vote.
The bill's author, Democrat Tom Amiano of San Francisco, told the Assembly his bill is good public policy.
There are times when this subject is politically radioactive. There are times when things get unfamiliar and uncomfortable to us. And the pathology of their resistance is always fascinating because it always results in some kind of scare tactics or overstatement or implication that those monsters I refer to will be treated differently now if this bill passed. And it's not the case.
Ammiano's bill failed on a floor vote. After the vote, Ammiano said his bill would have focused resources on the most serious offenders.
I don't think there is any real argument about the policy. I think it's excellent policy and worked for over 45, 46 states. But I think it's a radioactive issue to people. But, you know, if you don't start the conversation, this will never change.
Ammiano had also proposed another measure to regulate medical marijuana, a big issue in the face of a federal crackdown on medical marijuana growers. Ammiano decided not to put that measure up for a vote. He says he'll reintroduce that in the next legislative session when it might be easier to change minds in the legislature.
Not doing it in an election year, I suppose. I just, you know, people are with you, but when it comes to that vote, they think that they're going to see it on a flyer or something. And, you know, both sides of that coin are unhealthy. We should not be intimidated by that, but that shouldn't even be happening. But, you know.
The Assembly also rejected a measure that would have blocked tax breaks for corporations hit with punitive damages. That measure was proposed by Democrat Mike Feuer of Los Angeles.
This bill says that conduct that in the legal definition is despicable, malicious, fraudulent, or oppressive shouldn't be deductible as an ordinary business expense.
Feuer's bill failed on a floor vote. Lawmakers have yet to vote on a number of other controversial measures, including a move to reconsider a single-payer health measure carried by Democratic Senator Mark Leno of San Francisco. Reporting from the state capitol, I'm Christopher Martinez.
President Barack Obama has acknowledged for the first time that his administration has ordered drone strikes in Pakistan and other countries overseas. The statement came in an interview Monday night. The officially covert program has been drawing international attention as civilians in Pakistan protest the strikes and as activists in the U.S. protest where the drones are manufactured and controlled. A suspected U.S. drone strike Monday killed between 9 and 13 people in southern Yemen, raising more questions about the legality of carrying out these attacks when no official war has been declared. From Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
President Obama participated in an unconventional interview Monday night, a Google-sponsored video chat that allowed participants to directly question the president on topics ranging from unemployment to foreign aid to war. In a pre-recorded question, one man from Brooklyn challenged the president on his administration's authorization of drone strikes overseas and the civilians those strikes have killed. President Obama responded,
I want to make sure that people understand actually drones have not caused a huge number of civilian casualties. For the most part, they have been very precise, precision strikes against Al-Qaeda and their affiliates. And we are very careful in terms of how it's been applied. So I think that there's this perception somehow that we're just sending in a whole bunch of strikes willy-nilly. This is a targeted, focused effort at people who are on a list of active terrorists who are trying to go in and harm Americans, hit American facilities, American bases, and so on.
But Mary Ellen O'Connell, a professor of international law at Notre Dame, was not satisfied with the president's response.
The fact that the drones are more precise than other kinds of military weapons doesn't make them lawful to use outside of armed conflict zones. And as far as I can see, outside of Afghanistan, there is no right to use military force against anyone.
Additionally, though the government of Pakistan has given the U.S. permission to carry out the strikes, O'Connell says they are still prohibited by international law.
Unless we are participating with Pakistan regular government forces in a battle, an armed conflict that they have underway, we have no right to be using one-off bombs in the country.
And the drones may not be as precise as President Obama and the Defense Department have claimed. An estimated 400 to 800 civilians have been killed by drone strikes in Pakistan alone, according to data collected by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Pakistani Senator Saida Iqbal says this threatens the image and standing of the U.S. in her country.
The people in the country are increasingly starting in disliking America, and people are thinking that America can never do anything good for them.
Some Pakistani senators are even calling on their government to shoot down any foreign drones that enter the country's airspace. But Iqbal says that would only lead to more violence and suffering.
The best thing would be that they should give the technology to Pakistan and let the Pakistani Air Force and Armed Forces do the needful, because the foreigners can never understand what the area is. Very complicated.
Iqbal, a member of the current ruling party, says the U.S. has no right to commit extrajudicial killings in Pakistan or in any other nation.
America should leave every sovereign country, whether small or big, weak or strong, to decide for themselves what they want. We might be brown and they might be white, but that doesn't make a difference. We are sovereign people and we are human beings.
Last Friday, an anti-drone protest drew over 100,000 demonstrators to Karachi. Iqbal says the increasing casualties from drone strikes have motivated many different sectors of the Pakistani population to join together in these demonstrations. Anti-war activists in many U.S. cities are also protesting the drone attacks. Over the summer, the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum went into lockdown mode when members of Occupy DC came to protest an exhibit on drone technology. And in upstate New York, 38 protesters were arrested in April outside Hancock Field, a base used by the U.S. Air Force to control Reaper drones used in Afghanistan. Though there have been attempts to bring legal challenges against U.S. drone strikes, courts have largely backed the national security justifications of the government. Professor O'Connell says anti-drone activists must seek other channels for their opposition.
I think the best possibility now is for people within the United States to contact their elected representatives, let the president know that they do not want illegal killing being carried out in the name of our country.
Earlier this month, the Defense Department announced several changes it would make to the Pentagon's budget and global strategy. In a joint press conference, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and President Obama described a future for the military that explicitly includes an increase in the use of drones.
The Forest Trails Alliance will have a trail fair this Saturday from 4 to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Park in Nevada City. I spoke today with Zach Anderson about the Forest Trails Alliance.
We're a local community trails organization, a 501c nonprofit. And what we do is connect people's passion of trails into constructive opportunities to develop trails.
What are some of the trails that you've developed?
Well, we've been working with the Forest Service for quite a few years. We have around 30 miles of natural surface trail that we've built up near Downeyville in the Pliocene Ridge. We've worked on the local Pioneer Trail. We've worked on the local Loma Rica Trail, as well as quite a few private trails in the area.
Well, how do you build a trail?
Well, it's a real fun process, but a lot of people don't realize that sometimes there's as much as several years of planning that goes into where the best location to have a trail is.
Do you find old trails, historic trails that have been overgrown, and clean them up and rebuild them?
Yeah, a lot of times we start with a need, you know, so someone wants to get from the old mine to the bar, as an example, and then we might spend months and months reconning the area, doing reconnaissance, discovering where all the unique locations, the good views, the waterfalls, and all those kinds of things are.
Now, you have an event coming up, the Trail Fair. Tell us about this.
Well, we've been very successful over the last couple of years, and we have around 8 different trail projects that are coming up for this year alone. And since we have no paid staff, we really depend upon the inspiration and contributions from the community to get these projects done. And so the trail fair is really an opportunity for people to scratch and sniff on what's exciting and new for trails coming up in our community.
And where is it going to be?
It's going to be located at Siemens Lodge, which is in Pioneer Park in Nevada City. 4 to 7 o'clock this Saturday. We'll have beverages and food and all different kinds of information. We'll have our whole array of specialized trail building equipment out and all kinds of exciting things to do.
This is a good place for people to go if they might be interested in working with this group.
Absolutely, and we have a lot of really fun projects coming up. We're currently building a 5-mile trail that descends from the top of Harmony Ridge all the way down to the Scotts Flat Lake. We're going to be collaborating on the Tribute Trail System, which is an exciting new network of trails that's going to run down through Nevada City. And we have another 7 miles of trail that we'll be building in the Tahoe National Forest this year. So there's a lot of exciting ways for people to participate.
How about maintenance? Do you participate in that as well?
Yeah, one of the things that we focus on is actually kind of the science and engineering of trail design. So hopefully the maintenance is minimal, but also we work with local user groups to train people in how to provide good maintenance every spring after the snows and rains.
Now, are these hiking trails? Are they mountain bike trails? Or are they a combination of both?
They're a combination. We like to call them human-powered trails, are the things that we are most engaged in. And all of our trails use a very sustainable 5% grade, so they're very enjoyable to walk or ride in either direction.
And in general, how can people find out more about the Forest Trail Alliance?
The best way to find out about Forest Trails Alliance and our organization and events is to go to foresttrailsalliance.org.
And once again, what are the details about the trail fair this weekend?
The trail fair will be at Siemens Lodge, which is in Pioneer Park in Nevada City, from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock this Saturday.
Zach Anderson talking about the Forest Trails Alliance and the trail fair this weekend. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with KVMR.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Tuesday edition of KVMR's Evening News. KVMR's news program airs Monday through Friday, 6 to 6:30 p.m., and is produced by the staff and volunteers of Community Radio KVMR. Coming up at 6:30, we have a special edition of Making Contact and at 7 o'clock, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Closing out today's newscast, we have a commentary with Mark Cuniberti.
The next Euro nation to lose its triple AAA credit rating from S&P turned out to be France over the weekend, and although it may not seem like a big deal to Americans, neither did the Lehman Brothers failure in 2008, which eventually led to the financial crisis that almost ended the world's economies. Although Greece, Ireland, and a handful of other Euro nations have less than desirable balance sheets and have already come forward for bailouts, France, Spain, and Italy are much larger in scope and economic size and therefore have a much greater impact on all things financial in the global economies. Much like they did before, you can count on the Euro Central Bank and the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, bailing out France if it comes to that, but the larger picture reveals a more complicated problem than a simple bailout can remedy. The real issue here that the central banks of the world are trying to address is halting a domino effect in the bond markets. Bonds are just IOUs, and the bond markets are the place where all that debt is bought and sold. In 2008, when mortgage bonds started to go bad, it affected bonds of all types. When one bank started to see defaults and slow payments on its mortgage bonds, that bank would slow down and default on its payments to other banks. Because everyone held the same thing, which was those mortgage bonds, the banks quickly experienced defaults from institutions that owed them money. Fearing their own demise, banks then elected to default on money they owed to each other. This cascading refusal of debt payment permeated the financial system and the markets for all things debt literally ground to a halt. Credit and available cash dried up, and institution after institution found it impossible to obtain operating cash, let alone pay off any debt or the interest payments on that debt. In essence, the home loan market had gotten so big, when it crashed, it threatened to bring down the entire system. Fast forward to today, and we find the same problem now surfacing in European sovereign debt. A plethora of countries overspent and borrowed billions, if not trillions, to finance that overspending. Now those foreign IOUs, called sovereign bonds, are everywhere, once again permeating every corner of the global banking system. Making matters worse, insurance contracts on all that debt total trillions, and much like the 2008 crisis, those insurers probably can't pay due to the sheer size of the claims. We were assured after 2008 that too-big-to-fail institutions and their gigantic derivative bets would be reined in and reduced to manageable size. Being bought and paid for by these very same banks, however, regulators did very little. So now, here we are again with another lit fuse on a financial weapon of mass destruction, this time with a European label on it. Incredibly, the amounts needed this time around are even larger. As before, we can soon expect another fleecing job in the form of more bailouts administered by our Federal Reserve Bank, using our tax dollars to bail out the banks, who will certainly need more funds to weather this fallout. Truth be told, close to $1 trillion of your money has already been used for the euro bailout, but that's going to end up as just the price of admission when this is all said and done. Expect the same old excuse to save the system to be used once again, followed by more rhetoric and promises to fix the system. Then the whole darn thing will be forgotten until one day we start all over again. Someday it will be so large it won't be fixable. That's it for today's Money Matters. The views expressed are opinions only and may not necessarily reflect those of this station, its staff, management, or underwriters. My name is Mark Cunaberdi.
Well, that's our newscast for this evening. KVMR's Evening News is produced by the staff and volunteers of Community Radio KVMR and airs Monday through Friday, 6 to 6:30 p.m. Special thanks today to Mark Cunaberdi and Felton Pruitt. If you've heard something on this newscast you'd like to hear again, you can go to our website at kvmr.org where you can download audio or listen on demand. Coming up next, we have a special edition of Making Contact, and at 7 o'clock, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. For KVMR's news team, I'm Paul Emery. Have a good evening.